It's 7:44 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. This morning, we go trout fishing.
The fish aren't the reason we're here. It's the excuse we use to be here.
That story about the healing effects of fly fishing is coming up in a few minutes. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. For people with disabilities, video games can help them feel more included and accepted among their peers and social circles. But not everyone with a disability can play video games with a traditional controller. As Liz McCormick reports, one nonprofit organization in Kearneysville, West Virginia, has been trying to change that.
Stories online about video games can range from how playing can get you a new job to this year's biggest new games, or on the debate over whether video games inspire violence. But for some, video games are about social opportunity.
In a video game, you don't know that I have a disability.
That's Mark Barlay. He founded the Kearneysville-based Able Gamers charity in 2004. It's an organization that helps folks with disabilities play video games with specially made video game controllers. Barlay says the controllers help people with disabilities play like everyone else.
I've seen where a profoundly disabled person mentions that they play a game, and all of a sudden, while that person was being completely ignored in a crowd, the person next to them says, "I play that game too," and all of a sudden, they're friends.
Here we go. So we got Rocket League here, set up with an Xbox Adaptive Controller. Rocket League is like soccer meets Demolition Derby.
That's Greg Haynes. He's one of Able Gamers' 6 employees. He's playing a racing game on the Xbox One game system using an adaptive controller. This controller looks like a plastic white pad and sits on a table. It has large black buttons built into the device and outlets to connect it with other external buttons. If you're not familiar, a traditional controller is held with both hands, while your thumbs are used primarily to make the character or object on the screen move. This modified controller allows someone who may have difficulty holding a traditional controller navigate a video game in a way that's comfortable for them.
One thing that people don't think of when they hold a traditional controller is that about 60% of your digits are used just to hold the controller. And for some players with disabilities, based on a number of things, that may not be a reality. So something like the Xbox Adaptive Controller allows you to essentially take the controller, flatten it down, and have it be on a surface so that you have access to a potential layout of buttons.
Able Gamers works with game developers and engineers to create these specialized controllers. In some cases, they help people get devices that respond to eye movements, foot taps, breath, or finger taps. These kinds of controllers aren't sold in stores. Some of the devices are made in-house, but most are either purchased or made elsewhere. In 2018, Able Gamers helped more than 1,400 people with disabilities get back into gaming. 8% of those required unique, specially made controllers. Demand for these controllers is high, though, and Able Gamers says they're only able to help about 30% of the requests that come in at any given time. But some experts are concerned that relying on video games or technology in general for social interactions could be more negative than positive.
You can't replace social interaction because there is an increase in depression, anxiety among teenagers.
That's Associate Professor of Psychology Heidi Dobish at Shepherd University. Dobish specializes in child, adolescent development and lifespan social psychology.
Those that are spending a lot of time on Facebook, research is showing that they tend to have lower self-esteem because we are seeing an increase in anxiety, depression, loneliness, isolation, those sorts of things.
Dobish says access to video games for folks with disabilities can help a person feel empowered and create inclusion. But she cautions this shouldn't replace in-person interactions, especially for young people. However, inclusive socialization is one of the main benefits of video games for Jane Timmons Mitchell, a clinical psychologist and senior research associate at the School of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. She says video games, especially those with educational or social components, can be a great thing for children and adults. In the case of someone with a disability, playing video games with others can help them feel connected.
One of the things that is pretty well established is that those can really increase cooperation and social skills.
Both Dobish and Timmons-Mitchell agree finding balance is key, and that encouraging in-person social interactions and time spent outside, away from screens, is hugely beneficial to a person's mental and physical health, for those with disabilities and for those without. Able Gamers founder Barley agrees that moderation and monitoring video game consumption is good, but he says he believes there is still great power through video games, that they can create an avenue where everyone is on the same playing field.
That's the power of this world that we live in now, that I don't have to be defined by my race, my creed, my LGBT status, my disability. We have those shared spaces. We have those connections.
Barley says getting to play video games gives people the chance to run, jump, create, and be anyone they want to be. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick in Kearneysville.
In an effort to expand coverage of arts and culture throughout the region, our Inside Appalachia team has expanded to include a group of Folklife Corps reporters. The most recent episode of Inside Appalachia features the first story from that effort. Folklife Corps reporter Mason Adams brings us a story of a man with an unusually strong appreciation for bugs. He's an Army vet who says fly fishing saved his life.
Cal Chanet spent 2.5 years deployed in Afghanistan. He saw intense fighting and suffered concussions that led to seizures. When he returned to the U.S., he started taking college classes, but then dropped out to follow the jam band Fish around the country. He got into drugs.
You know, I was kind of strung out and needed some help.
He spent 18 months on the road and spiraled out of control.
I had 8 accidental heroin overdoses in a year. The whole time, it was like, man, I don't want to be doing this.
Then, one day, on his way to the beach, Kyle says he saw a sign for a Veterans Affairs hospital in Richmond, Virginia. He'd been up for 7 days straight on a methamphetamine binge, and he wanted to kill himself. He was in a car with the guy who'd made the meth. Kyle pulled off at a Walmart and convinced the guy to get out of the car. Then he apologized, locked the doors, tossed some money out the window, and drove off to check himself into the hospital.
I went through a month-long rehab program, but before that I was in basically in the psych ward, you know, detoxing from opiates and other stuff.
The VA moved Kyle to a facility in Salem, Virginia, which sits at the eastern gateway to Central Appalachia.
Man, it was probably the best thing that ever happened, you know.
After rehab, Kyle tried to settle into life in the Roanoke Valley. He spent a lot of time at the VA in programs for disabled vets. He was learning how to garden when someone told him about Project Healing Waters. It was another program for disabled vets focused on fly fishing. Bob Crawshaw is a Navy vet who's taught fly fishing to veterans for years. Bob was one of the first people Kyle met in the program.
We take vets that have never fished and we walk them into the middle of the river, and it just washes over them and they just relax. They just go.
He says when the vets step into a trout stream, peace comes over them.
Kyle's seen it, I've seen it. Kyle's felt it, I've felt it.
On a trip to Wolf Creek in Bland County, Virginia, Kyle, Bob, and a handful of other vets are trying to catch trout. One succeeded on his first cast, but the others are having to work a little harder to get a bite.
Good bug activity going around here.
This tree here is full of black caddis.
Man, I'm loving it. Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're mating. Some got eggs on them.
Yeah.
It's mid-May, which means aquatic insects are hatching and buzzing. Bob and Kyle know the flies well, and they know which fish like to eat them. Occasionally, a trout breaks the surface of the water. Bob says, that's great and all, but even if they weren't biting, that'd be fine too.
The fish aren't the reason we're here. It's the excuse we use to be here. And understanding everything that's in the envelope of the Army guys, what do you call it? Situational awareness. Understanding everything around you and why it's happening. It's the mystery of it all.
Situational awareness. That's something soldiers need to stay alive. When Kyle served in Afghanistan, he was usually the first guy through the door when his unit was searching for enemy combatants. He had to immediately process his surroundings and detect potential threats. A stray wire, a person holding a gun or a knife. These details were crucial to life or death. But that hypervigilance can make it hard to adjust to life back home. You can't just turn it off. Kyle says that even today, 7 years after he got out of the Army, his eyes still dart around, followed by his arms and upper torso. It's the muscle memory of maneuvering with a bulletproof vest and rifle. Bob says fly fishing takes those instincts and applies them to a serene, peaceful environment. On the banks of Wolf Creek, Kyle sees what kind of bugs are in the air and on the water. He uses that information to choose a lure that mimics what he's seeing. He's constantly adapting his actions based on what's happening around him in the stream.
So you see that right there on top of the water? So that big thing, that's a crane fly. I have a lot of crane fly imitations. It's a mayfly that just popped off the water. So we got a lot of bug activity here. I just saw a damsel limp dancing around. So, yeah, man.
Kyle got so into fly fishing that the classes at the VA started to bore him. He craved more. So he started watching YouTube videos to learn new fly making techniques. He bought tons of gear. He went fishing every week.
And then I became a volunteer really fast in teaching guys, and I still am.
He even started selling the flies. He had mentees and mentors, and one of his fly tying mentors had a daughter, Jessica.
My dad kind of took him under his wing, which my dad does. He's that kind of person, but there was always something special about Kyle.
And Kyle felt there was something special about Jessica. They met at a festival in Roanoke. She felt a connection right away.
I told my mom, I'm going to marry that man. That first time I ever met Kyle, I went home that day. And I was talking to my dad about him, and my dad actually warned me off of Kyle. He was protective over Kyle and not me.
Jessica's dad didn't want his daughter to break Kyle's heart, but that didn't happen. They married and bought a house in Roanoke. Fly fishing and fly tying have been part of their relationship since the beginning.
I think at this point I know more about fly fishing and fly tying than a lot of people. I'm slowly gotten used to like the names of the material. You know, he can tell me about a fly and tell me the material he's using or the hooks he's using, and I can visualize pretty well what he's talking about.
Kyle blends old school and new school techniques to make flies that are utterly his. For example, he'll use a modern neon colored synthetic thread, but mix it with natural feathers, all tied in a traditional way. The other thing that makes Kyle's flies stand out are their eyes. They move and cause the fly to move, which apparently makes them more appetizing to fish. He's reluctant to share what he calls his recipe for the eyes, but he says it involves a blend of glues that keep them from falling off in the water. Kyle's fly tying workshop takes up a sizable room on the second floor in their house. Every surface is covered with hooks, various kinds of hair and fur, feathers, synthetic threads. There's a big desk with a dozen or more drawers, each filled with, you guessed it, more fly tying stuff. Kyle spends hours here, and Jessica often hangs out with him.
And so he ties these beautiful flies, and I actually take them and turn them into jewelry and keychains. So I embed them in resin. I have a necklace here. He could tell you the type of fly that's in it.
It's like basically a dry fly Adams made out of snowshoe rabbit feet and grizzly hackle.
Let me translate that for you. The Adams is a fly Kyle ties that's meant to resemble a few different insects, including mayflies and caddisflies. Snowshoe rabbit describes the kind of fur that Kyle used, and grizzly hackle is in fact not grizzly bear fur, but a style of feather. Basically, it looks like a hook with hair and fur sprouting off of it. But I'm not a fish. Jessica's taken it and embedded it into an opaque resin. So now it's a pendant on a silver necklace.
So I get kind of a little bit of my own little bit of creativity. I don't have his creativity, but I get to take it and turn, you know, something that's, very much a sport into something that has some beauty to it.
So Jessica contributes to Kyle's fly tying, and he contributes to her jewelry making. He's also paying it forward by working with other vets like Moyer Edwards. Like Kyle, Moyer struggled to adjust to civilian life after serving in the military. He also loves fly fishing.
I'm going to be doing it for as long as I'm able.
Moyer served 20 years in the Air Force as a mechanic. He learned to tie flies by reading books, but then he found Project Healing Waters and he met Kyle.
Kyle has given me some flies that he tied, and I try to imitate him. And he's a good man. He'll come in sometimes and he'll just say, here's a fly. You take it, you know.
Moyer says Kyle's ties are better than anything he's ever bought in a store or online.
They are just as good. They're hand-tied. They're not machines. No machines doing it. They are hand-tied flies, and they're tied very well. I'm going to call him my master. He's that good.
On the trip to Wolf Creek, Moyer's the vet who caught a trout on his first cast. Kyle can't land a trout, but he does catch a couple of Roanoke bass. After lunch, Kyle and Moyer chat for a few minutes before getting back on the creek. They're not swapping war stories, but talking about, what else? Fishing.
Yeah, it makes it easier to cast.
Oh, do
it? Yeah, it does.
Okay. Well, with a bigger fly.
Yeah.
And bigger flies are hard, kind of a little harder to cast.
Well, yeah, but some of them flies, man, they're pretty light. It's mainly deer hair and flash.
It's small talk among friends. Low stakes, set aside a burbling creek that's alive with hatching insects, lurking fish, singing birds, and even a small water snake making its way upstream. For these veterans, it's a chance to linger a bit longer, doing what they love.
That was Mason Adams, one of Inside Appalachia's Folk Life Corps reporters. You can hear this and other stories about life on the water on our most recent episode of Inside Appalachia. Find it online at wvpublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.